I am thrilled that we are having this call, and I will do an official welcome of our honored guest. But before I do that, I just want to take a moment. What would it feel like if we all allowed for the possibility that we are exactly where we need to be on this beautiful summer Tuesday? Wouldn't that be a gift if we could all let go of multitasking and remind ourselves that what brought us here is really a beautiful, beautiful wish, a wish to love a child. And that's pretty cool. I'm inviting all of you who are on this call to just take a moment and acknowledge yourself. Acknowledge yourself for following through on that wish, because if you're on this call, you're following through on that wish, and some of you in spite of tremendous obstacles. I think it takes guts to do that. So congratulations. So now I am ready to officially welcome our honored guest, Dr. Turek, the founder of the Turek Clinic in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, in Beverly Hills, and truly one of the most outspoken thought leaders in the field of men's health, men's sexual health, and reproductive health. Paul, we have, as you know, we have a link on the registration page to both your website and your remarkable list of achievements. I just thought that instead of reading that list, I will say that in the last couple of decades since I've been in the baby-making world, I've heard and read so many wonderful things about you from both colleagues and patients. It's truly a pleasure to welcome you in our community. Yes.
Thanks for the lovely prayer. It's an honor to be here. There's things out there that a lot of us in the field are thinking about, but patients need to know about because they're moving quickly, and there's a lot of humanism behind the science.
Yes, yes, yes. And I'm so glad that when you suggested that we link the healthy dad, healthy sperm topic with that elegant word, epigenetics, because to me it's a topic that ultimately encourages our clients to be really fully engaged in their own healing. And I know that that's something that you've been speaking about a great deal, and it's also very much what's at the center of my work. I often actually tell clients that as painful as it is when our children don't show up when they are summoned, they could be saving our lives. And I think you're gonna tell us something more about that.
I think it's very practical. I think the word epigenetics is scary, but I guess the conclusion of the talk today would be the more we know about science and the deeper we go into genomics and transcriptomics and metabolomics and epigenomics, the more that we realize that lifestyle matters the most. Mm-hmm. When people say, what can I do to control this? What can I do to help? The answer is live the healthiest life you can. Treat your body like a temple. It really is the answer.
And so, Paul, perhaps we can dive in, and before moving on to that elegant word, a little deeper into the subject, perhaps we can start with your questions, the questions that you suggested, which is, you know, what's wrong with the half a century old semen analysis, and then how that relates to our topic today.
One of the things I was thinking of exploring is why the semen analysis is 50 to 75 years old, and it makes some sense, but it really doesn't tell us much. Mm-hmm. And unless it's zero, you really have no prediction of fertility. So I would call it a blunt instrument in the assessment of a man's fertility. It's sort of like naming stars in the universe. They weren't necessarily meant to be named, but it does order our existence a little bit to make us feel more comfortable when we name them. So we put order to the semen analysis, but it is quite a biological variable, and it's not like a glucose test, which can, you know, has normal ranges, and it's tightly monitored. It's different. I always take it with a grain of salt when I'm looking at it, and I look more at the person. And so what's happened as a consequence is it's not predicting fertility very well, unless it's zero. You know, I've seen pregnancies naturally at every sperm count imaginable down to 60. I usually hug the partners, the female partners of those guys, because I'm like, man, you're fertile. But it's amazing what a woman can do with very few sperm in situations.
I've seen the same thing, so I'm so glad that, you know, that you're saying that, that, you know, people are told from the get-go, this is not going to work. And
as a general statement, you could say, well, aren't sperm counts falling and men becoming more infertile? And we had a meeting in Washington. It's in a blog on www.tarekonmenshealth.com. So everything I say is basically, you could see opinions of that on the blog. But when we met to talk about fecundity worldwide, there was no agreement that it was actually changing, and that it was biological, and that the semen analysis was changing. But again, you don't measure fecundity or fertility with a semen analysis. You measure it with actual pregnancies. And one mathematician, I think from the government, stood up and said, if you just look at delayed family planning plans that couples use in developed countries and advanced maternal age that leads to, you could probably account for 10 to 15% of a difference in fecundity of this population versus the last generation. So a simple math equation basically could assume all of the differences. And, you know, so we don't really agree that there's any natural decline in fertility. It may be because of family planning and decision making or whatever, other things. I think that even if it is declining, I would say if sperm counts are falling and there's no change in fertility, maybe women are more fertile. Maybe they're fertile at younger ages. Maybe we control our environment so much that there's no worries, and they can have babies earlier, and they're able to handle whatever decline. Maybe it's not necessary to have a sperm count of a wildebeest.
So are you saying, you know, environmental factors? How about environmental factors? That doesn't worry you?
I think there's influences, but, you know, you're going to see it with epigenetics, so you'll see that. So there's just the extant data that exists now does not convincingly show a change in fecundity by age. It may be different because families are planning later or not having kids till later. That's different. That might be, you know, that's environmental in a sense. It's the environment of each couple that determines how they're going to pursue their fertility goals. But it may be more elective family planning.
Right.
So the semen analysis isn't the big picture. The big picture is fertility. But what we have learned is that there are some men who have normal semen analysis and aren't fertile, and there are some men who their semen analysis can lead to miscarriages and things. And so that led everyone in the field to drill deeper into the semen analysis. So let's look more at sperm function.
Mm-hmm.
And that has led to a lot of doors opening up. So one was morphology, looking at sperm shape. Maybe that was more predictive of fertility, and it is a bit. But it's become very difficult to do and hardly reproducible, and it's lost a lot of its meaning. And you can't judge a book by its cover. So unless it's all the same abnormality, sperm morphology, you know, I don't rely on it anymore. Because unless it's syndromic and everything looks the same and it's all abnormal in the same way, it probably doesn't have much correlation to fertility.
Does morphology have to do with, I mean, is it also pretty subjective in terms of who is looking at it and the lab and all of those factors? Or
it's very subjective, and that's why it loses its precision. Because
mm-hmm.
I sent a morphology slide from one patient when I was a professor to five different IVF centers, and I had them send it back to me, and I had each of them read the same slide. It took a year to get the slide back from each one, and back and forth and back and forth. And we read it as 5% normal, and the range was 0 to 20. And so I realized, you know, most people don't know what they're doing, and it's not as strict as it used to be, and it's hard to do. It's just a good test, it could be valuable, but if only one person can do it, it doesn't have a lot of value. So
right.
It's lost a lot of its clinical value.
Are you saying that we can have someone with 1% morphology, and we can have this couple conceive either naturally or with an IUI?
All the time.
That's pretty good news, everybody. I can see smiles on your faces in my mind's eye.
Because most of that morphology is what's called stress pattern. So it's classified as abnormal, but most valuable with a low morphology is what are you finding that's abnormal? Everyone reports the normal being very low. Remember, 4% of a fertile man's sperm looked normal. 4%. So 1 versus 4, what kind of difference are we talking about? So when you look at what's abnormal in most men, it's going to be lifestyle issues, stress, travel, physical stress, emotional stress, varicocele, heat, exposures, smoking, habits, alcohol, and it causes a slight abnormality in the sperm that's not, I would say, clinically significant. It's called a minor hit. It's like a minor abnormality. The point is, morphology is not a good functional measure of sperm. I rarely order it anymore unless there's some really specific thing that I need to look at. Then other things came along, like putting sperm in hamster eggs and seeing if they fertilize and doing this and that, which have some relevance, but you can't really take eggs out of hamsters all the time and do it, and it's expensive and it's not that predictive. And then along comes this toxicology assay called DNA fragmentation, which was published in Science in 1980. So Dot Evanson did nice work in Science, and it's a measure of toxicity in earthworms and other species where there's environmental toxicity. It's got a lot of scientific basis. And his first study compared sperm of different fragmentation rates in bulls. He found like 9 species, and they're predictive of fertility in 9 species, and they did humans, did a small study. And it was only like 20-something men, and said if your fragmentation rate is above, say, 25%, then you will not conceive naturally on this good earth, which led to everyone ordering the test on men. It was high, so the DNA was fragmented too high in lots of men, and they said, you need donor sperm. That was a kind of a reaction. Of course, everything regresses to the mean in science. As you add cases, things aren't always as clear-cut, and so the curve kind of rises, and it comes down to a comfortable place, and now we know that if the fragmentation rate's high, then your chance of conception is lower. It's not zero, it's lower.
If we can kind of review, what are some of the causes of fragmentation, and what do we do
with that?
So again,
I would say things that are toxic to you, smelly solvents, chemotherapy, habits, smoking, tobacco, other things, anything that's toxic to the body will get measured in sperm. And the classic one is heat exposure, fevers, things like that. It can be temporary or permanent. Varicocele is a large vein in the scrotum in about 40% of infertile men, and that can cause it. And so we found out that fixing varicocele can lower it. So what can you do about it? You remove the toxin, number one. So lifestyle issues generally. Eat a healthy diet. We can talk more about that, but you know, I'd say paleo is the best. Mediterranean's close. Eat like a caveman. Fruits, vegetables, nuts. Forage a little bit. Maybe you starve once in a while. Fresh meats, you know, organic if you can.
Does the frequency of ejaculation affect fragmentation?
I'd say minorly. If you went, say, a couple of days versus a week, it probably won't. If you went a couple of days versus a month, it would. So old sperm can do it. The sperm are old in the system.
Right. So don't save it up.
And then a good antioxidant supplement can help. That can help motility. And the other thing is age. So age is a common cause of elevated fragmentation. So if you take a man from 30 to 80, his fragmentation rate will go up 1 point a year. So from 30 to 40, it would go from, say, 20 to 30%, and then it'll go from 30 to 40% at age 50. It goes up to the 70, 80% range in older men. So the system isn't good at fixing it, or it's taking longer. Who knows? But it's age-related too, and actually antioxidant supplements were shown to reduce that age-related difference. And some of it may be inherited. It may be just the way your sperm are. We don't know why they're like that. So that has some value. and it's taken 10 or 15 years to figure it out, but it's nothing compared to epigenetics, which is kind of the next wave. And so I think everything is going to pale in comparison to this. I think we probably should talk a little bit about epigenetics.
Yes.
The blog that would explain it is called The Real Reason You Are Who You Are. Epigenetics is new. Genomics is the study of the genes, and that became popular after the Human Genome Project got completed 10, 15 years ago. And then we knew sort of the landscape of genes, the 50,000 genes in the genome. And we looked at them, and we realized that, hey, we're not that different. I mean, genetically, we're 99.5% identical to the person on the phone with us. We share 97% of their DNA with mice, and bananas have 50% of our DNA. So
I don't know how I feel about that.
Vast differences in our look, our phenotype, the way we look, is really not explained by vast differences in the genome, in the genes. So that led people to explore the marks on the DNA. Epigenetics came about after the Genome Project came about. And epigenetics is really any alteration to a gene or its activity without changing the DNA or causing a mutation or any change in the sequence, because the sequence would be a genomic problem. So this is any change. They're usually marks on the DNA, and those marks will tell a gene to turn off usually, or turn on, but usually turn off. So it controls the expression of genes. Essentially, every cell in your body has the same genes, right? But your nose is your nose and your ear is your ear. So why is that? It's because the expression of the genes in those cells is different in each tissue. That explains why your nose is a nose and ear is your ear. And we're not identical looking, even though we share 99.9% of our DNA with someone next to you. It's explaining the large differences we thought genetics would explain better. So it's essentially the new plastics. It's the latest. And I think in the blog, I like this quote. I wrote, DNA is not your destiny. Epigenetics is your destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's,
what's fascinating with it.
We are fluid and changeable, the way I like to put it.
That's it. It's fluid. And that explains evolution, because if you look at evolution, there's probably 54 mutations each generation that get passed on by men. It's generally driven by men, genetic mutations. But there are innumerable epigenetic changes that are passed on. So it's going to account, it's filling in the gap of everything there. It's the non-genetic variation that we see all around us, within our bodies, outside of our bodies. It's really the new plastics.
Yeah.
It really is.
So in other words, there's a tremendous amount that we can do to affect the gene expression.
Yeah, and it's looking like evolution, I call it day-to-day evolution, is, here's an example of maybe evolution, maybe not, but if you take a Japanese man who's lived, family's lived there for 1,000 years, bring him into America, his risk of gastric cancer goes down in one generation, and his risk of colon cancer, which is an American disease, Western disease, goes up. Probably diet-related, right?
Right.
So they have high stomach cancers, we have high colon cancers, it inverts within a generation.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing if you go the other way. That is not a genetic mutation, right? It's even within a generation. That has to be something else, and the only thing that can account for it is epigenetics. It's the little changed variations. Your body sees the new diet coming in, makes some epigenetic changes, and those are heritable.
I love the way you put it, that it's a day-by-day evolution. The way I talk about it in the Fertile Heart Ovum practice is that we're giving birth to the and conceiving the next you. And tomorrow you might be somebody else depending on what you do today. So
right.
It's similar to the day-by-day evolution.
Absolutely. Daily evolution. It's microevolution. Epigenetics came out, there's different forms of it, but it's now being seen to be the basis for many cancers, autoimmunity, and neurodegenerative diseases like schizophrenia and autism. Those are big areas where they've made a big splash and appear to be really important. And about for the past 5 years, several groups have looked at sperm. So you take the same technology, these big arrays, and you can look at the entire epigenome, 500,000 spots, a million spots, and it's wild. It's all informatics. So, you know, you couldn't have done this without the genomics, because all of the ways to analyze things are so robust informatically. I mean, they require computers to analyze. It's so complicated. So this couldn't exist years before because there's no way to study it. So there are a couple of companies now looking at this, or lots of scientists have done work, but it looks like sperm, the epigenome of the sperm, can predict its fertility. There's a company called Episona right now in L.A. that is looking at that, has a product out, and it's a home-based product. You send it from home. It's very robust. They started with, I think they looked at, you know, Neanderthal sperm, and they look at ape sperm. You can look at anything. I mean, it's really quite translational across species, and but it's very interesting that there are patterns of marks, epigenomic marks on sperm, which can predict its natural fertility. Still early, there are patterns, different patterns, that can predict its ability to result in good embryos.
And so what the folks on the line are interested in, and this is fascinating, is that to what degree can those patterns be affected by things like quote-unquote stress? I'm not crazy about that word, but I'll use it tonight, and lifestyle. Like, where is the line? Are there certain markers where we can't go any further? We can't go beyond what is given.
So I'll disclose that I am an advisor to them. So I have some inside information, but I'm only going to disclose stuff that's published. But basically, it's so new, it's hard to know, but it appears that, like other epigenetic things, like autoimmunity, et cetera, there appears to be lifestyle patterns that change things. A study was just published, maybe it was 6 months ago, very, very highly rated journal on obesity. So here's an example. And the blog is last week's blog, and it will lead to the paper. But
yes,
it's about,
I know. It's a great blog.
Yeah, so if you take men who are overweight, so that's a lifestyle issue, and we know that overweight men, traditionally, we know that their sperm counts are lower and their fertility is impaired. And it correlates with the degree of obesity, moderate, mild, or severe. It's impressive. That's epidemiologic data, population science data from 15 years. So we know that if your body mass index is in a good normal range, you're more likely to be more fertile and have better sperm counts than if they're not on either side. Same true with women. So that's pretty hard data. But not scientific, you know, it's not explaining why. But if you look at men who are obese and look at the patterns of their epigenome and their sperm, and look at men who are lean, they're different, and significantly different in like 2,000 areas of genes. So that's interesting. And a lot of those areas are centered around neurodevelopmental diseases like autism and also appetite control. So there's also this interesting fact that obese men tend to have the sons and daughters who are more obese. The obesity inheritance pattern is probably male, not female. And that's been known for a while, too, and this explains that. So then if you take men who are obese and you do surgery on them so they lose weight rapidly and go back down to not lean but close, and you look at the sperm before and after they do that, it's changing. It changes within a week.
So the pattern changes.
Yeah, so it's some of the most powerful data ever published that shows that lifestyle, because it's essentially a lifestyle issue, can change the epigenetic pattern of sperm. And right now we believe that there's two patterns. We believe that some of the pattern is inherited. It's called programmatic. So it's sort of recorded, and it's there. And there's other that's more developmental, or I guess it's called programmatic, where you can change it. So there's marks that are permanent and part of the record, and there's marks that are programmatic. And we don't know which is which yet. But I think within a couple of years, we'll have it figured out. And you'd be able to do this test and say, you know what, your sperm is probably destined to be this way, and we don't think there are lifestyle issues, for instance, eating better food, losing weight, stopping tobacco, things like that, that could change. Right. And what's
right.
also interesting is this is the point of that blog, and the point of this is you can take that information and say, listen, you need to take care of yourself not only to have a kid, but you need to take care of yourself because your kid could inherit some stuff that you don't want him to inherit if you don't take good care of yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the plea for Men's Health Month and Father's Day, which is when you get the love poured on you from Father's Day or Father's Day to be, you should take it and say, I'm going to give something back to you, which is my health, so I live a long time and I can have kids, and my kids might be healthier.
Absolutely.
So
and
that's
you want to
the argument. It's not whether you have programmatic or not. It's we need to figure it out, but it could be intergenerational. This study of obese men losing weight, I mean, if it's in the sperm, it's going to the next generation, right? And those changes are being transmitted. So clearly it's plastic.
Right.
I said plastics before. Now I'm saying plastic. It's
yes.
it's mutable. It's fluid. And that's amazing.
Changeable. Right.
So there's the rationale. And men won't change to necessarily live longer. They'll change if it hurts. If something hurts, they'll change if their life is threatened. And they'll change
we have to be in enough pain.
Right. And they'll change if a loved one says, do it for me. So the most powerful way to change a man is to have a loved one say, do it for me, not for you, do it for me. And then you'll get movement. And you'll get more movement if you say, do it for your kids.
Oh, I say that all the time. I use that line a lot. Your child is not showing up. Is really looking to save your life, Dad.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm a little selfish. I'm using all of these methods to help men live longer. That's my goal. I want them to take better care of themselves.
Yeah,
I don't
want them
to
dance at their children's wedding.
Right. I don't. And I, you know, men often say, maybe I'm too old to have a dad. And I said, listen, if you have kids at your age, you'll probably live longer. You know, you really will, because I'm an older dad too, and you're running. If you're not, you're running. So
they keep you young.
I love it. Anyway, I am a little selfish because my main goal in life as a men's health expert and specialist is to help them live better lives, longer lives, healthier lives. And I think all this stuff, and I'm just as an optimist as you are, I think all of this epigenetics is going to be powerful information that all the stuff we couldn't explain is now being explained, because we couldn't find things wrong with men for years, but now we're realizing it's right in front of us. It's the way they live their life, and it's probably going to have a profound effect on their fertility.
I certainly didn't know anything about epigenetics when I was diagnosed. It's just and told that with an FSH of 42, there's no way I could have a second kid. And I just thought it's worth an experiment. And the worst thing that can happen, the worst case scenario, is that I'll be the healthiest I've ever been, because I never
right.
wanted anything as much as I wanted the second child. Paul, I was watching one of your wonderful videos, and you were talking about the different patterns that men have with their libido levels and the desire to have sex. And what I see in my clinical practice, this is something that comes up for people all the time.
Yes.
You know, and so my question to you would be, when would you be worried? What is the frequency of desire that would put a question mark in front
good
of
question,
you?
Good question, yeah. No, that's a great, and there's very little about this, but, you know, I'm a great observer of men, and I would say, and I also work closely with sex therapists who I trust enormously, and I'm a bit of a scientist. And so I try to be objective, but I would say that I worry about libido when it changes. Think of libido as sex drive as breathing. Everyone has their own pattern. It's one of the issues in new relationships. Like, my libido's here, yours is here, how are we going to work this out? I'm a morning person, you're a night person, whatever. But there's also, everyone's kind of different. You know, and what that's based on changes. But they do have a little bit of a rhythm. That's one point, is that everyone comes in with their own kind of breathing pattern for libido or rhythm. Second is, you can't measure libido by having sex. You have to measure libido by desire. And you know, if you look at the formal definition of it, so I measure it, okay, so how often are you having sex? That's one measure, but that's complicated. That, you know, you have to meet somebody, you have to, you know, your partner, whatever, they have to be home, you're home, and whatever. But if you just said, how often do you think about it, meaning, you know, window shop, something, even self-stimulate, right? Because self-stimulate is easier than sex a lot of times because there's only one person involved and blah, blah, blah. But I used all of those to judge it. So how often, you know, 18-year-olds think about sex every 2 minutes, right? That changes. So there's a natural progression to real life mm-hmm. after that. But, you know, you can't, some people say, they're nowhere near like an 18-year-old. It's okay, but there's a natural progression there, so you have to understand that. But when you incorporate all of these elements, you'll find that people think about it pretty much regularly. They'll think about having sex, they'll masturbate, or they'll have sex. And all of that's part of the breathing and the rhythm. And when that's altered...
I think what I noticed, I work with very specific mind-body tools to address these issues, but it can often happen that just around the time when a woman is ovulating, that's when her partner will have erectile dysfunction issues. And so
we can talk about that. About that. So on the libido issue, I would say when it changes is when I'm concerned. And so in the Google lecture that you probably saw, I did it for Google Health at the Googleplex. But basically it said that if a guy just said, I can't remember the last time I had any interest in sex, maybe it was last August, that's a problem, right? That I would go after. The guy says, I just don't feel like having sex anymore, then that's a problem. And, you know, before, and I don't know why, you know, relationship stable or et cetera. So when you see these drop-offs like that, what I call them, like these cliffs, when they sort of go, like one guy said, you know, about 3 months ago, I just lost interest all of a sudden. I would chase that because you're going to find something with that one.
So you're looking for biological,
whatever, hormonal, biological, something. You'll usually find a reason. But there's always a variation to the rhythm. So that's how I typically evaluate it. And I take a very planetary view of it. Think about libido, sex drive, as kind of an orchid. It needs the right environment. It's got to be quiet. It's the parasympathetic nervous system. It's the rest and restore. Typically comes out when you're relaxed. Biggest violator of that is connectedness, your phone, right? First, that once you're connected, you're on guard. And once you're on guard, it's the sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight. Do you want to have sex when you're being chased by a woolly mammoth as a caveman? No. You kind of get out of there. That's the wrong nervous system. Sleep deprivation is a stressor. That's fight or flight. So we don't have woolly mammoths anymore in most of the world, but we're cavemen still. And what we have is we have pineal stress from flying across time zones, which beats us up. We don't sleep well. We have sleep stress, pineal stress. We have emotional stress, financial stress, all this stuff. We're exhausted. And that is exactly the wrong nervous system for libido.
Right. Certainly with a challenge that is as emotionally charged as a fertility challenge, it's really a multi-layered phenomenon.
Right. So the acute problem is, honey, come home tonight early because I'm ovulating. And the guy's cutting a deal in Manhattan, Midtown, and he's like, damn, I got to get home. That's stressful, all right? So guess which nervous system's kicked in, the wrong one. And he's not going to have a great libido. So a nice response from a guy is, listen, I will, you know, meet you when I can, but, you know, let's have sex in the morning or late tonight or something. Just take the stress off of it because that will help. The other thing for the woman is women have thought about this for millennia, which is how do you get the guy engaged when it's stressful? And the answer is, you know, sexting is a nice word. Anticipation is a nice word. So why relationships change when they become stable and sex isn't exciting is a lot of loss of anticipation because you're dating and you see someone irregularly and you look forward to it. Well, look forward to it in a relationship is nice. So sexting, maybe seeing some flowers on the table when you get home or, you know, something to just get some level of anticipation going is
use
nice.
Your use your imagination.
A little bit, yeah. And it just takes the ledge off of it and things happen better. But it's a hard one because it is. There's these two battling nervous systems and you will not have a sex drive if you're running from things.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
And the erection problems, which are separate, the erection problems that occur with timed scheduled sex are basically not erection problems. They're usually stress problems reducing the erection and the ability to keep it. So these men have quite normal erections at other times. And typically for that is, again, get the anticipation going, getting the other nervous system, getting relaxed.
You can be creative. So how about I read some of the questions that came in. This gentleman says, some REs believe that day 3 versus day 5 embryo survival is impacted by sperm. So if embryos look perfect on day 3 and have a 100% fertilization rate and then arrest by day 5, is sperm to blame? Do you
Great
believe
question.
In that? Then he says, my sperm has severe viscosity, but motility is good, 67.5%, and total motile sperm is 288.6. Is it a problem?
Could be. Great question. That is a perfect play for epigenetics. It is. I call it dissolving embryo syndrome. Right? So everything goes well at the start. You let them go in a dish, and bam, things fall apart, and you get nothing at the end. Horrible situation. I get it, maybe 5 to 10 times a week I see this.
Hmm.
And everyone's asking me, is this sperm? And so the answer is maybe. So it could be either sperm, or it could be eggs, or it could be the lab, right? So it's easy to kind of sort out a couple of them. One of them, you ask the lab, how did it go today? And if it happened in a bunch of cases where things didn't go well, then it may be a lab issue. It's rarely that because they have so much quality control. And then you can ask, is it the egg? But you can't really answer that one. But you might see it more with older maternal age and sometimes with younger, but it doesn't necessarily correlate with that. And then you can ask, is it sperm? And that's one of the most powerful tests for sperm is the epigenetic test. This company called Episona has an assay, and you can do it. It'll tell you whether there's a significant male contribution to embryo quality. And that's the first-generation product. And you see that fertile men generally don't have a problem. So that can answer the question. The next thing is, what do you do about it? So I love to blame sperm if I can, but it's hard to do because it really orients you. What should we do next is the question, right? Is this going to happen again? We can't afford to do this again. It's really important, and that's exactly where my mind is right now, is can we blame sperm or eliminate them as a problem, and can we do something about it? And there's some very exciting work being done by a company based out of Stanford, California, the university, that I can't talk about, but it's going to be great. Feature about this is it's probably not every sperm that's affected with epigenetics. It might be a population issue, and some sperm might be fine. And how can we find those sperm and use those instead? And my answer is imitate the cervical path. Imitate nature. Right, so it's not about someone picking a sperm, it's about nature picking a sperm. So that's all I'm going to tell you about that, because it's really exciting. Coming out in a year or two.
And in terms of the viscosity, Paul?
Probably irrelevant. Probably not an issue.
You think it isn't?
No, viscosity is very rarely a problem. It has to do with once the ejaculate is 30 to 60 minutes and it's liquefied, comes out as a sort of a semi-solid like tapioca, it liquefies from 30 minutes to an hour, and then you assess its thickness. It's sort of like molasses, and it should strand a little bit. And the treatment for viscosity is to put it up and down in a syringe a couple times, make sure the enzymes mix really well. You can add some sometimes, and then you can do an IUI. But that wouldn't be a cause of embryo issues. So that's a case of unexplained and then poor embryo progression, and that merits a fragmentation rate because that could be the – and so the issue is how often is sperm deciding embryo quality, and that's what we don't know. Rene Reopera, a well-known geneticist and oocyte biologist, sperm biologist, thinks it's around 5 or 10% that of the time that this would be a sperm problem. We don't know for sure, but it's probably a chunk of it, but we don't know how much, and epigenetics is going to be one of the ways to figure that out.
And doing whatever you can on all those levels. I'm just going to keep saying that because I think there is so much about this that remains in the unknown.
Yeah, I think, Julia, that you can always say health matters because we know that epigenetics is altered by health. We don't know the timeline for it. If you
health matters. You know, every thought matters. Every feeling matters. We tend not to think about those aspects of the human organism. We talk about it with this catch-all phrase of stress. You know, that's something that my crusade is to translate some of that so-called stress into humanese, a little more human vocabulary. How about one more of these questions? Currently, morphology numbers are at 0 for this gentleman and 1% after recording levels of 4 and 6%. And motility and count are both good. I have been told by doctors that it's uncommon to have such healthy parameters for count and motility and a 0% morphology.
So that's about a 5%er. It's about 1 in 20 men, 1 in 25 men maybe are like that. So it's not uncommon in my field, but it's uncommon. But again, I don't know what to say except what are the abnormal forms? What do they look like? What's their pattern? What's the distribution? If it's syndromic, then that would be, if it's all lollipop sperm, then yes, that's a problem. That's genetic, and your sperm are going to have trouble conceiving. You're going to have trouble conceiving naturally and even with technology. An IVF doctor will say, you need IVF because the data is that if you have normal semen analysis and the only thing abnormal is the morphology, you're not going to fertilize eggs well. Well, honestly, Jamie Griffo in New York did a great study on that. So, you know, does morphology matter anymore? And he looked at IVF cases where they didn't use morphology to decide, and they didn't. The failure rate of fertilization was 1 in 250 cases. So it becomes a rare event.
What a great call. I'm really so grateful for having you on. Do you want to just give an official contact information just so
everybody, you can just contact us on a site called www.theturekclinic.com, and you could do a consultation. I mean, you can literally say, I'd like to get a call, and I'll do calls, and I can look at data, your chart, your stories, etc. And we're quite socially mobile, you know, that way, and we work quickly. So we have patients from all over the world, and the blog, you can comment there.
And I'm just going to say that if any of you want to experience what epigenetics looks like in the Fertile Heart Ovum practice and with this work, we have an introductory teleconference series so you can call in from anywhere in the world, and that's starting next week. We're going to inspire moms and dads. I'm encouraged to have more and more men on those calls.
You know, my bottom line is the word epigenetics is intimidating, but the bottom line is it gives us more control than we ever thought we had.
To me, that's why this call was so wonderful, because it really inspires us to fully engage in our own healing. Thank you so much, and thanks so much, everybody, for joining us.
It's good work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. Okay. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.